Welcome to this edition of the 5Cs podcast. I'm your host, Charlene Norman, and this is where we discuss all things clarity and collaboration for the community of climate change makers. In this episode, we continue our series about risk with our special guest, Sandy Trust. In the last episode, we began to uncover the topic of risk, some of the specifics of how the extreme weather patterns we see in the previous 10 years are impacting the risk models that have been in use for decades, and some of the cracks that are starting to show in those old models. This week, we look at how the financial risk models currently in use are missing 87% of the economy, how the lessons from the Challenger shuttle disaster in the mid-80s are a wealth of knowledge for us today, and how the rising sea temperatures have doubled the risk for hurricanes. Now, when recording this series, Hurricane Milton had just blown through the central parts of Florida, not 2 weeks after Hurricane Helene had struck the northeastern parts of the same state. I'm in Canada, so we got some fallout rain effects for a few days. Big deal. But then I started thinking about the insurance bills, and I started to wonder how many more insurance firms will completely pull out of Florida now. Here's a fun fact. Just those two hurricanes are estimated to cost a minimum of $80 billion and could go as high as $100 billion. That's a staggering amount of money. It is equivalent to Bulgaria's annual gross domestic product, GDP. Now, to put that into perspective, think about the companies known as PepsiCo, Johnson & Johnson, Tesla, and even Dell Computers. Each one of them all earn somewhere between $80 billion and close to $100 billion a year. Like I said, that is a staggering amount of money. Somebody's got to pay it. I found the perfect actuary for this series. Sandy Trust is based in Scotland, and he leads the UK Institute and Faculty of Actuaries, the IFOA, research papers on climate change and sustainability in collaboration with Earth System scientists. Sandy also sits on the IFOA Council and is the past chair of its sustainability board. All of his details, as well as the reports he mentions, are in the show notes. Now, I got to tell you something. Sandy and his team are doing cutting-edge, bleeding-edge work, and I'm over the moon to share his thoughts and findings with you. Fair warning, you may want to lean in and listen intently because he has a bit of a brogue. Let's join the conversation where Sandy continues his story about working with a climate scientist to understand why the results don't seem to be making sense.
So these large national institutions are saying, if we have a hot house world with 3 degrees of warming, I'll get into where we're at currently, roughly 1.5 degrees of warming, and it's getting pretty bumpy. Yeah? So, or we limit global warming transition. And these are large financial institutions, hundreds of billions of dollars under management, very sophisticated risk models, and they're published, audited, check results saying there is virtually no difference economically between a hot house world and limiting global warming. And this didn't kind of feel right. So we spoke to some leading scientists at the University of Exeter, in fact, Tim Lenton, who's kind of missed a tipping point, so I'll talk about it later. And we said, well, maybe we could work together, actuaries and scientists, to dig into this a bit and find out what's going on. Why don't these results make sense? And that led us back to, in my view, one of the most dangerous pieces of economic research ever undertaken on the planet, undertaken by a guy called Billy Waterhouse. And he set about answering this question, what might the economic damage of climate change be? And he did some sensible things. He said, well, what's happened in the past when it's got a bit hot? People have worked less because they're too hot. They work less. I'll extrapolate that into the future and say people will work less when it gets hotter. On the face of it, doesn't sound reasonable. And then he made another slightly more heroic assumption. He said, well, climate change impacts the weather, so anybody who works indoors won't be impacted by climate change. So I can exclude 87% of the economy from my analysis. And, of course, by looking backwards, by definition, you miss risks that haven't yet happened. So unprecedented threshold climate conditions, temperatures, etc., etc. So you're using a technique that by definition misses all the future risks, so failing to imagine what could happen, and you're excluding 87% of the economy. And the answer is, you won't be surprised to hear, very small impact from climate change. 2% GDP loss at 3 degrees of warming. But that's because you've excluded all of the risks and most of the economy. Now, that's so, okay, interesting, some economists did something. Well, interesting, but unfortunately quite damaging, because it's very easy then for politicians to say, look, a reputable person says it's not going to be very expensive, so let's not do anything. And Nordhaus's work was checked carefully, peer-reviewed, by economists, but not by climate scientists. Climate scientists were horrified that Nordhaus's work had written papers on it, have reputed it for clear misinterpretations of climate scientific work in Nordhaus's conclusions, but he has not retracted it. Oh, okay, fine, some guy did a dodgy model. Well, yes, but then I'll explain actions as I go. The thing called the NGFS, the Network for Greening the Financial System. What the heck's the NGFS? Well, it's like a kind of a central bank and financial regulator club. So I forget the exact numbers, but let's say 40 or 50 central banks, global regulators, are part of NGFS. NGFS says to all these banks and regulators, we must do climate change scenario analysis. What's a reputable methodology? Oh, that chap Nordhaus did something quite clever. Should we use that? So the NGFS helpfully produces economic stress scenarios for climate change damage assumptions in the hottest world and disseminates them to regulators around the world and the regulators around the world. So we must assess the resilience of our financial system to climate change. We must do some modelling, we must do some scenario analysis. Ah, those clever chats at NGFS have helpfully produced some scenarios. Here we go. There you go, regulated entities. Let's do that. And so that is why the results are surprising, underpinning the methodology that global financial regulators are instructing all regulated financial entities to do in climate change scenario analysis, is this deeply flawed Nordhaus methodology. So this is, if I wanted to be provocative, I could say you could argue global financial regulators have instructed financial entities to greenwash the public on the economic impact of climate change because they're using a methodology that simply doesn't see future risks and excludes large parts of the economy. Now, just to be fair to NGFS, they have upgraded their scenarios, they're gradually getting more realistic, but they still don't capture any risks. So effectively, what we're doing, Sharpeen, is we're looking backwards from the deck of the Titanic in April 1912 and saying, it's been a smooth voyage so far. I don't see why it won't be in the future.
Holy cow. It is stunning. And it now puts into perspective, just as an aside, the big hurricanes that have just gone through the U.S. People are saying there's been no change whatsoever in the hurricane season. The speed, the velocity, there's no difference. So therefore, you can't put climate change because of this. And I've been trying to rack my head thinking, why would people believe this? Because it does not, to me, it doesn't feel right. What you've just explained puts so much into perspective. People are holding on to very old information. People are holding on to very old models, and getting people to change the models. Is that part of the problem that you and the scientists are having right now? Is, guys, we got to change a model?
Yeah, I think it's a really astute observation. I think the question really is, why does risk management fail? Because that's really what we're discussing. Why do people not want to see this? Why don't they want to believe it? If I'll touch on hurricanes briefly and then get into why does risk management fail. I have the enormous privilege of leading the UK professions, actual professions, research gender with scientists. I meet and work with industry bodies and policy bodies on climate change. That affords me the chance to meet some really interesting innovative setups. I met a specialist hurricane risk modelling firm earlier this year, Reask. And that is really quite funky. They're saying, well, the ocean temperature is warming. That's a fact. So the question is, what does that warming ocean temperature do to hurricane formation? What might that do to hurricane risk on the east coast of the States? And I'm not a hurricane specialist, but this is what they said to me. They're a really, really critical driver, both of hurricane formation intensity is sea surface temperature. So you don't get hurricanes till sea surface temperatures hit 26 degrees Celsius. It doesn't drop. Physics doesn't work. And then they reckon the next threshold is 29 degrees Celsius. That's like risk on hurricanes. And this year, first time, is the main developed region, the North Atlantic area, where hurricanes almost hit 29 degrees for the first time. So that's unprecedented. And now, I'm not saying anything about hurricanes, I'm just talking about sea surface temperature, which is the record, right? And then the question is, of course, well, what does that mean for hurricanes? This is where you have a bit of complexity, because of course, you can have a particularly bad hurricane here or a particularly good hurricane here with the same sea surface temperature. There are lots of other factors. It's uncertainty. It's not right? What they did is they used artificial intelligence to model hurricane formation in other parts of the world which had those sea surface temperatures, and then they built a model to simulate millions of hurricanes and where they might go and how intense they might be, the damages. And their estimate this year was that hurricane risk had doubled, not up by 10% or 20%, doubled. And if you're just looking backwards from the deck of the Titanic and looking at temperatures historically and hurricanes historically, you're never going to get hurricane risk doubling. And what that is a really good example of a threshold event. The conditions change so much, they go past the kind of risk thresholds. You might have that hurricane example. You might have flood defences and unprecedented precipitation overtopping flood defences because the risk distribution has changed. Another way of thinking of it is as a tipping point. You know, if you back when we were in school, we might sit on our chair in a boring class, and as long as you don't swing too far, you're back to stability. Once you go past that threshold, all bets are off. So that was just to touch on hurricane risk. And what they're not saying is we can predict the number of hurricanes the intensity we're going to hit. They're saying the likelihood of hurricane damage is all using that approach. So yeah, let's go back to why does risk management fail? There's a fantastic book on this, absolutely seminal, the Margaret Heffernan's Willful Blindness. Really, really good book, why risk management fails a lot. So One is psychology or incentives. If your partner starts working late, has to go away at the weekend, heavy work conferences, you would much rather assume that your partner was working than having a pet, even if it was getting quite telling. It's just difficult to acknowledge. We'd rather not talk about it. So there is a huge amount of psychology in why risk management fails. And then incentives. Maybe my job depends on it. Maybe if I call out, I'll be ostracized and that kind of stuff. So another horrific example of that book, posters of x-rays, the medical profession said, well, hey, we can use these x-rays to check pregnant ladies and their babies and do in utero fetal x-rays. And a researcher noticed a spike in childhood leukemia rates in, toddlers. What the heck's going on here? Did some fantastic research into the claims of these in utero x-rays. But because x-rays were the thing, and because she was a woman, I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember her name, but I think it was in the 50s or 60s, she wasn't taken seriously. They didn't want to hear it. It took stunningly, dreadfully, importantly, full 25 years for the profession to stop doing in utero fetal x-rays, even though they had definitive research that evidence that it was causing child leukemia. So risk management fails because of incentives and psychology, and that's really important. I think when you get to climate change, God, it's just a lot easier to pretend it's the weather changing and it's not actually happening. This is a big, heavy topic psychologically. Coming to terms with this is tough. I would personally say I've been through great cycles. I can really understand why people would much rather read the headline that says it's not happening, climate will change. Huge psychological incentive. A lot of people are also paid a lot of money to provide our economy with energy in the form of fossil fuels. So they can't like that money in their job and their status. So can we find a way that maybe lets us just keep doing this a bit longer? And I can understand that. So you've got kind of incentive psychology. Communication is another reason risk management fails, because the risks are not always highlighted clearly or communicated well. Very famous risk management failure is the Challenger shuttle disaster, which was a great tragedy that took place in 1986. Six months before the Challenger shuttle disaster, was a letter from an engineering guy to a bunch of people in the shuttle program about a technical failure. And I won't read out the letter, but I will read out the cost program. It is my honest and very real fear that if we do not take immediate action to dedicate a team to solve the problem with the fuel joint, then we stand in jeopardy of losing a flight along with all the launch pad facilities. So 100%. It was well known that there was a tech weakness in the Challenger shuttle program that could cause a catastrophic failure. And that was clearly communicated, but not communicated in the right way to the right people. So action was not taken, the consequences. So incentives and psychology, communications. Do you want to come in on that? Because I can see you looking aghast.
I am looking aghast because I remember in 1986 when it exploded and everyone was shocked, and I have never, ever, not once heard that, gosh, you know, they knew about it. And I'm jumping now to present day saying there's so many who are saying, hello, hello, hello. And I don't know what the answer is. I have personally come down on the side that we're using the wrong words. We're not saying the right things. There's something in the communication. And at the same time, Humans don't do anything until it directly affects them. So we never worry until someone in our family or our friends has something horrible, or other than the businesses that have had increased insurance because they are in the weather pattern zones, the danger levels, other than businesses that have to spend more money because their supply chains are impacted by this, that, and the other thing, I fail to see how we can get the message out fast. Because as you say, times have changed. We have new models. We have to pay attention to those new models. And we have to do things differently, fast.
100% agree, Sue. And that's a bit of the paper we wrote, obviously, in 2022, I think. Climate change, too many odds in our favor. We're kind of really trying to present climate change as a risk management problem.
Imagine that. The current financial models in use are missing something like 87% of the global economy. Imagine how that might change the probability models. Imagine what that might mean to our pension returns, our insurance premiums, and our investment strategies. Imagine what might happen if we applied some of the lessons learned from the Titanic and the Challenger shuttle to how we look at the weather. I know, that's a very tall ask. Think of it this way. Had we known beforehand about the unintended consequences that we live with today of the actions that we took decades ago, we'd have asked for a do-over. But do-overs are fantasy. What Sandy and his team now are doing is providing a roadmap to do better. And frankly, that do better is in the highest good for all.